Aftershocks by Andrew James. A Master and a Slave. I did what you asked. I read the chapter you said to. Months ago, Chad had given me a book to read, and I had, though not all of it. I had read most of it, bouncing from chapter to chapter, focusing on the pages that seemed to coincide with what we had been discussing in our session. It was a homework of sorts. In his own way, I think he had been calling my bluff by asking me to read that chapter specifically. I think he knew I hadn't really given it my all. The one on ambivalence? What did you think? It felt like that was the one that would make the most sense after last week. After everything that's happened with all of this, I thought maybe it would give you some answers. I nodded mutely. It had made sense. It had made a lot of sense. That was exactly the problem. When you're struggling to understand yourself and then, out of nowhere, a chapter appears in a small beige book that speaks to you. No, that wasn't right. It didn't speak to me. It spoke about me. I'd sat in a small brown leather chair swallowing dry air over and over again as I turned each page, slowly reading the last few words as I did so with a hunger that shocked me. Here it was, all of it. Someone had written me into a chapter. Somehow, in 10 short pages, my entire struggle had been encapsulated and recorded. It had left me with a sense of reassurance. I had read this all before, of course, before seeing Chad, before this book. I had read it online, in forums, when I had desperately and cautiously looked to see if I wasn't alone, but always the words had felt out of context. The stories and memoirs and hidden dreams of people I had read before all seemed slightly out of pace, as though there was something missing from their tale, but in this one simple chapter, it had all been put together. It scared me. It's hard to even say it out loud, I mumbled. It was hard to speak it out loud. Of all the thoughts we had shared, this was the one that scared me the most. It's like I want to think of those things that he did to me, and I want to remember them because they suddenly become erotic? That isn't right, but it's as close as I can get to the way it feels. That was it, wasn't it? That was exactly what the problem had become. Somewhere, somehow, all that time ago, when he had broken me, he'd also reassembled me, but it wasn't right the way he put me back together wasn't right. There was something just a bit out of place, some connection that existed to all of this, that I had that others didn't. Maybe that was why Chad made me read the chapter. It was entitled Ambivalence. I had to look up the word to be sure I understood. After all, if this chapter was going to mean that much to me, I should be sure I understood what I was getting myself into. It meant having mixed or contradictory feelings about something. The basic definition barely gave it credit for the huge fuck you that the word meant when I had read it. It was a big middle finger and a fuck you in my mind. The kind of middle finger that you have to shake your head at because you know it's a well-deserved middle finger. That was pretty exact, though. Maybe it wasn't heavy enough to truly define the feeling, but it was as close as one word would probably get. Ambivalence. Contradicting thoughts. It didn't feel violent enough for me. Not for my liking. Not angry or bloody enough for my mind. Contradiction was black and white. It was yin and yang, or yes and no. This feeling I had was more brutal. It was a bloody kind of fight, not a mere disagreement. My thoughts were at war with one another. In one corner we had me. Well, the me I knew and thought and believed to be real, it was the me of my goals and dreams. It was the me I showed everyone, the me that had been successful and won friends and been in love and made money and helped people I cared about. That was me. And in the other corner was, well, me. The other me. But the other me was angry and afraid and unsure and wanted to burn down the life I had built. Now, to be fair, that fight wasn't happening all the time, but when it did, it left me confused and ashamed and frustrated. It was a mix of feelings brought on by constantly losing a fight to the other me. After each bout, I would feel wounded and degraded and hurt. That was ambivalence to me. The chapter had shared the stories of others like me, men and women who had been abused as children and now faced the sins of their abuse in the present. Most of their stories had been as tough to read as my own would probably be had I ever chosen to put it into words. Instead, I left it hidden. Still ashamed to voice it, the words from the book had stuck in my head, and I had gone to sleep that night with them burning into the back of my eyelids as though they had been carved there by the red-hot tip of a long poker. The very thing that is despised also brings pleasure. In the pages that followed were story upon story that I had read over and over again, reading and then rereading to see if I had missed something or if I had indeed read the words right the first time. Here was a young girl leaving her door open at night so her older brother would come in and cuddle. She now felt responsible for the abuse she received at his hands. Here was a man who awoke at night touching himself to the memories of his abuse, and another who used his memories and fantasies of an older sister's abuse to calm him during times of stress or anxiety. The more I read, the worse these people's stories became. Here was a woman who could only be satisfied if she imagined herself being raped by a stranger. When that no longer was enough for her, it progressed to her rape by many strangers, publicly. Here was a woman who wanted to disembowel a man during sex. The list went on, and rather than feeling disgusted by these thoughts of these victims, I found myself feeling somehow less ashamed. It did nothing to quell the anger I felt in myself over my fights with myself, but instead made me feel somehow less alone and less guilty. I wasn't the only one. Did they ever win? I wondered. Did they ever fight like I did with their mind inside their head? Did they ever win that battle with themselves, when they wanted more than anything to not give in to those thoughts and fantasies? I won, but not always. Sometimes I couldn't win, and no amount of hiding or distracting or running from those thoughts ever got me far enough away once I lost. They would chase me down and finish the fight. I looked up at Chad. It's so hard to even admit. Most of the time I felt completely normal, but then all of a sudden I would have this terrible thought that shouldn't have been erotic, but it was. Does that make any sense? It's not all the time, that's the weird thing. It's not all the time, it's just sometimes, rarely even. But when it's there, I can't get it out of my head. That's when the demon shows up. I could see that clawing, gnarled hand rise slowly up from the back of my neck, and its impossible long fingers with their razor-sharp nails stretching out until the shadow that started at my back eventually covered my entire mind and then my eyes. My hands went up, and as hard as I tried to grasp that claw to pull it off my mind, I couldn't. It was insubstantial, and my hands passed right through it. Eventually, I would just give up and wait for the demon to leave. You said that the demon only took over when you were tired, is that right? Tired, yeah, but at the same time, no. I could tell he didn't understand that answer. Hell, I didn't understand. I didn't know how to explain something that was this elusive. There was usually some other feeling involved, too. Most of the time when the demon was there, I wasn't really tired, but I should have been tired. Does that make sense? It was as though I should have been tired, exhausted, but I couldn't figure out how to be. He nodded his head slightly. Were you restless? He asked as he wrote something down in the pad of paper sitting on his lap. Did you feel restless, like you couldn't turn your brain off? Not restless, that's not what it was. Restless is sort of like being excited. I know what restless is. I get restless when I have a big test the next day, or I can't wait to be on vacation. That's restless. It was more like a toddler again, like I was telling myself to go to bed. Go to bed, Andrew, but my brain just said no. There was always more to finish, more to do. I could go for days sometimes, but I knew I was supposed to be asleep. I just wasn't sleeping. It felt as though I didn't need it, even though I knew I did. It had started months back when my work had reached its peak. Some of my employees had approached me back then. Shortly after all this had happened, they told me how worried they had been about me. I was running 16, 18, 20-hour days a lot of the times, and sometimes I wouldn't sleep at all, just shower off the day's sweat and stress and get back to it. I had been handed a tremendous opportunity then. An additional second region added to my territory meant I was managing another office 5 hours away. 5 hours seemed like a breeze at first. It was a quick car ride south, time for me to be alone with my thoughts, to listen to the radio, to smoke a cigar and enjoy the road. I could stay a day or two and then be back to manage my other teams from my main office. The idea sounded great in my head, and of course I had taken the opportunity. What else was I going to do? This was the chance I had been dreaming of 2 months into the new job, into the job of my dreams, the youngest guy in a major international company doing the job of building an office and a team in a top market, and then out of nowhere, a manager at a satellite office quits, leaving his struggling market in turmoil. The company was faced with two choices: close it down or see what this young upstart could handle. So they offered me the opportunity to interim manage. It was doubling my responsibility, but it was a chance to show them what I could do. It was too big an opportunity to pass up. I took it, and the work began to pile up. The job wasn't an 8-to-5. I had never expected it to be, but I suppose I did expect to have basic things like eating, sleeping, you know, the basics. I don't know when the job officially became my life. I don't know if it was a gradual or if it all happened at once, but it had become my world. I ate shit and slept at my office. The 5-hour car ride down south was happening more and more frequently. Some weeks I would work 12, 15-hour days before taking the ride south, only to be up again early the following morning to work 12 more hours and drive back. Then I'd do it again the next day. Days blurred and stretched and seemed endless. Nothing seemed to ever end, but that was okay. We were winning. The interim job became permanent. And then even more fell on my lap. The main office was growing under my leadership. Employees were thriving and performing like they had never done at the company. We were winning. On one trip for a conference with the company in Florida the year before, I stayed up for 5 days working. I shouldn't say I stayed up for 5 days straight, but damn close. I slept here and there, probably 2 hours a night. According to my iPhone, I'd slept 7.5 hours that week when I left, but you should have seen what I did. I changed the face of the company while we were there. I mean, I changed it. It was true. I had made a huge difference in those 5 days. I had sat on the afternoon of the second day there with my boss, an hour before the company reassembled for a leadership dinner. We had found a secluded spot in the bar at the end of that day, taking a moment to breathe and discuss what we had understood from the classes and sessions. He'd sat there across from me and posed a challenge. He had asked if I understood the difference between significant and successful. Then he'd stared at me and sipped on his Malbec. "You are successful," he'd said. "I want you to show me significant." I'd looked him in the eyes and said, "Give me 3 hours. I'll give you significant." And I had. I had proposed an idea that very night, received corporate oversight, and even assembled a team. By the time the conference was over, I had created significance. Within 2 weeks, my idea was implemented, and I had turned the company around, but it had taken so much. Walking through the airport on the way home a few days later, I remember the tile floor beneath my rolling suitcase sliding up and crisscrossing before my eyes. I had to shake my head to get the mirage to stop. I almost fell standing in line at the TSA. I had nothing left. I had given it everything. "You've told me how much you loved that job." "I loved that job." I said it with all the air in my lungs. "I loved what it was like every single day. The people I helped, that was the best part. Helping them get somewhere with their lives. I had people who got married because I was able to help them. People who got their lives where they wanted to. People who got to travel to amazing places because of me. I threw myself into that. You know, the more I helped them, the better off I did too. They gave so much for me. It was incredible what they gave. But it took so much from you too, didn't it? He asked softly. He was staring directly at me as he asked the question, and I knew this was one of those questions that was meant to be answered directly. He wasn't going to let me wiggle out of this one. 2 years I had worked that job. For 2 years my workload had increased, and each quarterly review I heard the same thing from people over and over. This will never last. You're going to burn yourself out. You can't sustain that pace. But I did. I never expected the crash to happen the way it did. I believed I was limitless. I took this from my job. I took it from myself, not the job itself, I. But I guess if I'm going to blame it on myself, I can blame it on him too, right? Come on, let that answer be good enough. I could tell by the silence on his end that it wasn't. He wanted more. The nights were the worst. Once the day was over, I would lay there wanting to sleep. God, you do not know how tired I was sometimes. I mean, I didn't just work hard all day, I ran. There was one day I was literally in 3 meetings at one time for 2 hours. 3 meetings, physically, in them all. I ran from room to room with 5 different sales reps, all needing me in their meeting. I ran room to room for 2 hours, managing the conversations. I think it only happened once, but each day was nonstop. I peed in a bottle a few times because I literally didn't have time to go to the bathroom. I sat in my office and peed in a bottle. That's what my days were like. And the nights, he asked. Sometimes, just sometimes, I would just sort of lose it. I was popping Adderall to keep going. I'd slam some drinks at the end of the night to try to unwind. I'd realize I hadn't eaten anything all day and quickly forced myself to eat, just throwing some food down my throat. Then I'd go home, and it would just all hit me. Most of the times I could sleep, I'd pass out almost instantly. A few deep breaths, and then bam, I was out. It was the other times, though. There were these other times when things were alone, exhausted but unable to sleep, 3 martinis coursing through my body, laying in a bed that was supposed to comfort me but felt terribly lonely, I would lose myself. The day was over, but my brain wouldn't stop. It would run 1,000 paces ahead of me, forcing me to keep up with it, and as it wandered through all of my swirling thoughts, it would land on one that scared the hell out of me. At home, in the dark, the demon would come. It knew when I was weak and unable to fight it off. It knew somehow that this was a good night. When I was most alone, when I was most exhausted, when the stress of the day and the day before and the one before that had piled up until I was suffocating. The demon knew it was time to strike, and it wanted to show me things. I couldn't shake it off. Most of the time I could, but sometimes I couldn't shake it off. I just wanted to rest. My brain, I wanted it to rest. I wanted to sleep, but I couldn't. And all of a sudden, I wasn't there. That other thing was in control. It would show me things. Things I never wanted to see, but it wanted to see them. How do you explain that to someone? No one understands that. Well, that's why I wanted you to read that chapter. I think it explains it pretty well. I think that helps you make sense of all of it. I knew it made sense, of course. I knew it made total sense, because I'd read about all the people who had gone through what I had, and because of that, they were victims of their thoughts in the exact same way I was. I was a victim of my thoughts. They were casualties to the war of their memories, and similar thoughts and fantasies just like my own crept upon them, so they too struggled to rectify the feelings of attraction and longing with the feelings of disgust and the sense of betrayal that accompanied them. I could at one moment feel horrified by these thoughts, and at the same time be drawn to them with a compulsion that frightened me. Above all else, these were the reminders of my greatest weakness. They were billboards on a long, abandoned highway that had only one destination and no turnoffs. I was a slave to them because nothing else about my life felt out of control the way these thoughts did. It's completely normal to have these thoughts, but ask yourself why you are thinking about them. What about those thoughts makes you want to share them so badly? Why do you feel so drawn to wanting to express those fantasies and those memories? He asked. Again, his ability to ask questions with such simplicity that were so necessary to answer, yet impossible to do so, was unnerving. This was indeed the question. Why did it feel so demanding to share those thoughts and memories? Why did I crave an outlet for them, and more importantly, the thoughts they created? The common denominator was always the same. Stress, exhaustion, loneliness, sadness, and most of all, an overwhelming need to be understood and cared about, and laying in my bed at night alone, that was when it all seemed to kick in. All those feelings that had driven me into the arms of that one terrible, evil man all those years ago, all of those same emotions that had created the opportunity for him to do what he did when I was just a child, they were stuck there. That's what he made me. Here were the faulty wires and the broken levers, the out-of-order signs, the leftover scars of his crimes against me. Here was the disconnected point that had remained when everything else had ended, and he hadn't left. No one had ever cared, and he had never left. In the dark moments when I was alone in a bed, or exhausted and unable to control my mind, that's when it came. That's when the faulty wires would speak, and the images and memories and fantasies that disgusted me would come back and haunt me. Something about them made me feel less alone. They made me feel less hurt and less in pain. It was like my mind wanted to hide from how I really felt within these terrifying memories. How could that possibly make sense? You said you remember one specific time that was worse than the others. Yeah, there was definitely one that was the worst, I said. I think it was the last time, but I don't know for sure. Go with that then. How do you feel right now? Scared, I heard myself say. Alone. And where do you feel that? He asked. Silence for a moment, and then a whisper from a small, scared boy. Everywhere. The attic was musty. It smelled like an attic, and that was familiar, but it was hot, and it smelled hot. The man stood before him naked. He was dancing. His body moved and undulated in what the boy assumed and understood to be sexual and was meant to be exciting and appealing, but he felt none of those feelings. He did not feel that familiar stirring that often accompanied these visits with the man. There had been no touching yet. Just a trip to the attic, and because of that, there was no reason for his body to respond in the way it often did during his visits with the man. His body betrayed him only when the man's hands or body sought his own. Without that touch, there was no response. There was no betrayal. He simply sat there looking on at the man as his body moved to a music that was playing only in his mind. Otherwise, the attic was silent. Occasionally, the man's body would dip down, and some part or another would make contact with the boy's body. It would always be accompanied by a quiet, inward gasp by the man. At first, it would slide across him, but as the dance continued and the heat of the attic became oppressive, the man's body would cease to slide, and instead, the skin would grip his own like two pieces of Velcro being dragged across one another. The boy would inwardly grimace from the feeling. After the man's internal song had ended, he came closer to the boy and kneeled before him, gripping his face the way he so often did in a display of attraction that made the boy shudder and sickened him. He could smell himself on those hands. He could feel the sickening moisture of the attic and the hot Florida sun and the overly rough skin on his skin. And it disgusted him. He turned his head slightly to avoid the hands touching his lips if he could, but to the man it seemed to be a delightful form of control. He would slide his hand up from the boy's chest, and his fingers would spread as they traveled upward slowly, his palm driving the contact between the boy's skin and the man's touch until those fingers branched out beneath the boy's chin, and they would grip his face as they would push him in whatever direction or position the man decided. That was his favorite. This time was different, though. It was forceful. It was more forceful than previously, and the boy felt his head being pushed backwards until his body was forced to comply. It arched up, and he suddenly felt the rough scratching of the ugly pink insulation he'd been ordered to sit on against his naked back. The man's hands felt for his face in an almost feverish way until his palm covered his mouth and his fingers squeezed his nose shut. The boy felt an edge of panic take over. Where before there had only ever been pain, it was now tinged with this bite of fear. He gasped occasionally from between the man's grip and felt, rather than saw, the man's body hover above his as his other hand moved across the boy's body, exploring it, invading it. Then he was roughly turned over and thrown onto his stomach. Across that same hideous insulation, the heat and discomfort of the attic was now joined by the ungainly weight and press of this man's flesh atop his body, and the familiar fumbling that ensued was more frantic than usual. He could feel all of this as the skin from his chest was pressed harder into the insulation, and he could feel it bite and tear at his soft skin until the discomfort had reached a whole new feeling, until what he felt was so far beyond discomfort there were no words to explain it. Then there was pressure, and then pain. That was the last time, I think. I don't know why, but that was the last time I ever went there. I think it was just different that time. Why was I in his attic, you know? Why was I there? It was a disgusting thought to remember. To be fair, all of his memories were disturbing, but this one was tinged with something else, something more intrusive and reviled, where before there had always been some cursory amount of care, some pretense of feeling and friendship. This memory was different. This memory scared him. He used me. I mean, he completely used me. He didn't even try to fucking hide it that time, just used me how he wanted to, and the feeling was so different. But it's also the one that I remember the most, confusingly. Like, it makes me feel, I don't know how to explain it, it makes me feel so terrified, but it also makes me feel something else. How do you ever explain that feeling to someone so that they understand it? How do you explain to someone that a man covered your mouth and raped you atop a pile of insulation, and then later, when you never wanted to think of it again, you found yourself doing just that? You would think about it when you were tired and hurt and exhausted and stressed and worn out and God knows what else, but when you were at your weakest, you remembered a man's hand choking you. You remembered a man's body atop your own hurting you. That was what your mind did to you when all you wanted was a moment's peace. You pictured being in a broken world because that's what made you feel better about yourself somewhere a long time ago in an attic in Florida in the heat of the summer on a pile of insulation you had been torn apart. My body left that attic, but my mind never did. And in the worst moments of my life, when I wanted to go home and just be comfortable, instead, I went back to the place I never really left. I went back to that attic.